You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back, Brandon. How are you doing for episode number 129?
Correct. I knew that this week.
Did you really?
Wow. Yeah.
Brandon never knows.
Everybody listening won't know, but every single week I don't know what episode number we're up to. So I always ask Hamish, what episode are we doing this week?
Yeah, I'm always the one that updates it in the document for what we're up to and make sure that all the files are correctly labeled. Yeah. So it's on me to not make a mistake. I wonder if we've made a mistake, but we've just not noticed. Do you reckon we have? I don't think so.
Nah, I don't think so. Potentially, but I don't think so.
Imagine if we'd skipped a number at some point.
Is there a way of looking at of how many podcasts we've got total on like Spotify or something? Because maybe
true,
that would tell us.
That would be it. That would be the easiest way. Yeah.
It's like we've got 126 podcasts and we're on episode 129.
We've cheated.
Welcome, everybody. It's a very special episode. This is our 200th episode of the podcast today. So,
Oh, dear.
We got a lot to talk about today, if I can speak. It's like this, isn't it? Every quarter, the stock market just heats up and there's just stuff coming out left, right, and center.
Yeah.
From earnings and now what we've got to talk about, we got a little bit of earnings. Disney reported their earnings really late, but we've also got 13 Fs to talk about. So I'll talk about a little bit about Warren Buffet, his 13 F. And there's just a lot going on as well. You found some interesting stuff as well.
Everything seems to happen all at the same time whenever something's happening in the stock market. And we're talking about this off podcast just before that. It seems to happen every quarter because we have the earnings that come out. We also have the 13F filings where we get to see the trades of these big investors. And then if there's one or two other big news stories going on, which at the moment there's a lot going on in terms of cryptocurrency and Tesla and a couple of other things, then it's just all happening all at the same time. And it's just like, wow, what do we talk about? And
There's some weeks where we show up on our Thursday morning and we're like, man, there's really nothing to talk about. It's like, do we really want to talk about the Federal Reserve saying something? That's like our lead story. But yeah, right now it's just, there's a lot to talk about.
Crazy.
Should we talk about it?
Yeah, we should. But first of all,
I think so.
Today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. And it will basically allow you to keep track of all of the different types of gains. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, then it will do all of those calculations for you. Currency gains if you're buying shares internationally or if you hold foreign currency. So if you're Australian, buying shares in the US, for example, or any combination of different foreign investments. And then the main reason why I have personally been using it over the past few years is for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 10 different reports that can be used at tax time to easily work out things such as capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/Young Investors. That site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/Young Investors. So you can use that link, sign up to a free plan and use it for as long as you want. But if you want to sign up and to a paid plan and get extra features, then you can also use that same link to get 4 months off a yearly subscription. So go check it out if you're interested. And thanks to everyone who has used that link. You have been supporting the podcast. I almost said supporting the channel for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we do have a channel as well.
Yeah, we do.
So it's
the channel. You wouldn't have been wrong.
And podcast. Thank you.
That money that we get from referrals goes straight into getting the podcast edited every week and produced and edited. So it actually, you guys using or signing up to ShareSite actually does make a difference with the podcast. Okay. Should we get started? Do you want to talk about Warren Buffett first?
Yeah, yeah. So
let's talk about Warren Buffett.
Yeah, give us
the- it's 13F time. So for those, maybe if you're new to investing or new to the podcast, 13F filings, essentially, I think it's if a big investor in the States, I think it's over 100 million in assets under management.
Correct.
So big name investors, they have to file a form with the SEC, a 13F filing every quarter. And what that document says is it says everything that is in their equity portfolio, which is very handy for us because it means that every quarter we get a publicly available document from Mr. Warren Buffett or Mr. Michael Burry or Monish Pabrai or whoever really, telling us what's in their portfolio. And you can look from quarter to quarter and see, okay, so they've been clearly buying that or selling that. In reality, you don't actually read the SEC documents themselves because that would just, it would just melt your brain. But there's websites out there. The one that I use all the time is called Dataroma, but I've been using an app called Ticker.com. There's what's the one that you use?
Whale Wisdom is a good one as well.
Yeah, I knew it was something whale, something whale. but those, what those websites do is they track the filings from quarter to quarter. And they will just, instead of saying he owns this, this, and this, and this, this, and this, it'll say he's buying this, he's selling that, blah, 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 so on and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. And
anyway.
And I mean, they are very insightful. A couple of limitations to these that we always talk about every quarter when we're talking about these 13Fs. They have up to 45 days after the quarter to report this 13F. So that's why we're seeing it now in the middle of May for the quarter that happened for the first quarter of this year. So we're 45 days after that period. So any big investors kind of wait to the last minute so that they have as much lead time when they're buying their investments. So that's just one limitation. Another is, of course, that we don't get to see short positions or other types of assets as well. So a couple of limitations, but we do get to see the bulk of their stock market purchases. And for someone like Warren Buffett, for example, who we know doesn't go short and is very much investing in just in stocks for a significant part of the Berkshire portfolio, it's a good insight to what they're buying, selling, and holding and that sort of thing.
And usually he holds stocks for like decades. So it's not too crazy. Like it doesn't really matter too much if you see the stocks that he's buying 45 days after he bought it kind of thing. But that is the number one limitation, is that what we're getting, what's coming out as public information right now could have actually happened on like the 5th of January kind of thing.
Yes.
Like it was quite a while ago. So it's always looking backwards. Okay. So let's talk about, this isn't actually Warren Buffett's 13F. This is Berkshire Hathaway's 13F. So it's important to remember that that's either Warren Buffett or Ted or Todd. However, all of the big moves that shift the portfolio by like 0.5% or 1%, that's always going to be Warren Buffett because Ted and Todd just aren't managing that amount of money for Berkshire. So anyway, the key takeaways from Buffett's Q1 13F, definitely there is much, much, much more selling, than buying. Very little buying, actually. So I looked this up. All of the sells added together reduced the size of his portfolio by 3%. And all of the buys increase the size of his portfolio by 0.9%. So a lot more selling than buying. Another interesting thing is that the portfolio size didn't actually increase this quarter. The value of the portfolio didn't increase this quarter. And that was really, you know, baffling to me because I would have thought it would keep going up. I mean, the S&P 500 went up something like 6 or 8 or 9% or something in the
ridiculous.
First quarter. Yeah, I know. It's just bonkers. But Berkshire Hathaway's stock portfolio is literally like the same value as what it was. It didn't go up, didn't go down, just stayed flat, which is really weird because the last few quarters, it has been just on an absolute charge.
Right.
So I was like, okay, well, why didn't it go up? And then I kind of just started thinking, what are the possible reasons why it wouldn't be going up? And well, the first reason is obviously Buffett was selling a lot more than he was buying. So if you sell, a lot of your positions, naturally your portfolio is going to go down because more of that money is going to be turned into cash. But the other thing is, I thought, of course, Apple Apple is like 40% of Berkshire's portfolio, right? It is this massive chunk. And what I looked at is I looked at the quarters, the last couple of quarters of Apple's stock price performance. So if we rewind a couple of quarters, okay, so in Q3 last year, Apple went up 27.2%. Then Q4 last year went up 13.6%. This quarter just so happened that it was down 5%. For Q1. So naturally, if you've got a stock position that's literally, you know, 40% of your whole portfolio, if that stock doesn't perform, if it underperforms, if it goes down, then it's going to be very, very hard for that portfolio to increase in value.
Yeah. Berkshire's portfolio is very much dictated by Apple at this point, considering, what did you say? It was 40%+ of
It's about 40% even now.
Yeah. And I mean, what you just described with Apple's stock price in terms of Q3, about 27% up, and then Q4, 14%, and then down 5%. That has been what we've seen really across the board with a lot of businesses, in that in the late quarters of last year in 2020, businesses were doing very well, stock prices, I should say, were doing extremely well, especially for a lot of big businesses like Apple and a lot of the tech businesses. But recently, things have kind of been a little bit more uncertain. We've gotten more information about potential inflation. People really don't know whether this is temporary inflation or whether it's going to be sustainable. And all of a sudden, everyone's not as sure as they were in the last half of last year, where everyone was like, okay, we have a vaccine, this pandemic is you know, there's an end to the, there's a light at the end of the tunnel for this pandemic. But now things are a little bit more uncertain, I think, in the markets, and yeah, Apple is kind of one example of that happening to a lot of different businesses at the moment.
Yeah, exactly right. No, it's an interesting time, that's for sure. Should we go into a little bit more as to the specific buys and sells that he made in the quarter?
Yeah, what's he been selling?
He's reduced in 11 different positions, and then he sold out of two stocks completely. So the stocks that he sold out of were Synchrony Financial and Suncor Energy, but they didn't really shift the portfolio very much. It wasn't like him saying he's selling out of Bank of America or anything. They're kind of just like two that were, you know, down the lower part of the list. So nothing really to talk about with what he sold out of. Doesn't really make much of an impact. He did reduce in 11 different stocks. So I'll just talk about the ones that are of significance. There's really three of significance that stood out to me. The first one is that Buffett reduced 98%. So you can effectively think that's like selling out. Reduction of 98% in Wells Fargo.
Whoa.
So that has been a trend, right? Been a trend. He has been selling Wells Fargo. However, this is pretty much writing's on the wall, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm getting rid of it.
He's been trying to get rid of Wells Fargo for a little while now. So this is just the final, the final bit, but pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. So Buffett's basically out of Wells Fargo. And I mean, he sold down as well in JP Morgan, I think, or has he already got rid of JP Morgan? Maybe it was US Bancorp. No, he didn't sell down in Bank of America, but it was one of the other banks.
Right.
But it just kind of cements what we've been saying for like the last two, three, four quarters, is that Buffett is just continually selling US financials. But this drew me back to, he said in the Berkshire
annual meeting?
Shareholder meeting. Yes. Shareholder meeting, that he actually really likes where the banks are at, and he believes in the US banks over the next like 10 years or so, and he thinks they're in a much better spot than where they were 10 years ago. However, for Berkshire Hathaway, personally, they don't really want to get stuck in that owning more than 10% of multiple financial institutions, because I think then they get deemed as something like a bank holding company, and it's just hell in terms of regulation and filling out paperwork, and it's hell for both the company. Buffett was saying it's hell for both the companies and also for Berkshire Hathaway. So they decided that they just reduce the exposure to the banks and more basically back the one they think is the best, as opposed to just backing the whole industry, I guess.
That's really interesting. That's just another example of another thing that these big institutional investors have to, another challenge that they have to deal with. with that we just wouldn't have to deal with. Like, if you imagine your portfolio was the Berkshire portfolio, you know, you could hold all of the different types of banks and have them as big positions in your portfolio, have them as, you know, 10, 15% of your portfolio. Like, Buffett likes to have big positions. And you, of course, would be nowhere near holding 10% of each of those banks. So, you don't have to deal with that at all. It's just an interesting, I didn't know that was a thing where if you hold multiple banks over 10%, that there's some new regulations that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
But it's just another thing that I think makes it easier if you're a smaller, more nimble investor.
Absolutely. It is kind of strange. And we've spoken about this before of just how few businesses there are out there that would actually make a significant impact if, you know, to Berkshire Hathaway, if Warren Buffett were to buy them, you know, it's just, they keep running into roadblocks. It's like, here's just like banking regulations, and then it'll be another thing and there'll be some crackdown. Oh, you can't control this company because of some law, you know, it's anti-competitive or something. And then there's just the general problem that, you know, Berkshire Hathaway is trying to sink like $50 billion into something that they've just got. It's like, okay, take your pick out of these 10 stocks.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I can't remember the exact number, but I was looking at the S&P 500 and which businesses would be big enough for him to put, I think it was 10 or 20% of his portfolio into it. And it was like less than 15 businesses that were even there, which is crazy to think.
Yeah. Oh, well. I'm sure it's a good problem to have, let's be real.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's not complaining about the success Berkshire's had over 50 years. So.
Berkshire's worth too much. Oh, my life sucks.
Yeah, it's kind of like that thing when you start complaining about taxes, like that's like a good complaint to have.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So that's Wells Fargo and his thoughts on banks. He also reduced his Chevron position by 50%.
Whoa.
And this is the reason I find this one interesting is because it was only two quarters ago that he added Chevron into the portfolio.
Wow.
So he's held it for two quarters and then he's chopped it in half.
Oh my God.
So I don't know if he was uncomfortable with the amount of money he had in Chevron or whether, you know, towards the end of the quarter, he had a change of heart and is trying to get out, but he just only sold 50% by the end of the quarter or something else. I don't know. One theory that I speculate, I chucked into my video that I made is that could it be a response to shareholder pressure? Because I know that Becky Quick, when she was asking those questions from Berkshire shareholders, she voiced a lot of questions about climate change, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, and decarbonizing their business.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be a fairly big point. They did spend quite a while on talking about it. So maybe Warren Buffett has said, you know what? We're clearly seeing shareholder pressure. Obviously, this would have happened before the shareholder meeting. Mm. But maybe even at that point, he was like, oh, we're seeing shareholder pressure wanting to get out of oil giants and that sort of thing. I don't know. That's just speculation on my part. But it's just a bit weird, to be honest. Buffett buys in. He wants to hold companies for decades and then two quarters later, he chops the position in half. So it's like,
Yeah, it really is. Like every time we get a new 13F out of Berkshire, especially over the past couple of years, it's just kind of cemented in my mind that he's definitely investing in a different way than he did, say, like two decades ago or three decades ago, where he, I think, was much more... the philosophies that we kind of talk about and that we follow, he was much more following those philosophies, I think, a couple of decades ago. Now it seems like there are other pressures and other things that he is kind of, dealing with or I'm not really sure, but it is strange, right? We had the airlines where he got in and out and then the banks, he held them for a while, I guess, but yeah, another one where it's only been a couple of quarters and he's he's not out of it. He's just dropped it by 50%, but it's certainly not one where he's building it up to be a big position like an Apple or a Coca-Cola or something like that. Yeah, very strange. Exactly. I don't know what to think about it.
Yeah, I don't know either, to be honest. If you have any thoughts on it, then leave us a comment over on the YouTube version of the podcast for sure.
Mm.
So they're the really two notable ones. There was another one he sold down in Merck. He sold 38% of his Merck position, but they were the only three reductions that actually had like any sort of significance on the size of the portfolio. Like the, I think the reduction in, was it Chevron or was it Wells Fargo? One of those two was like a 1% change in the portfolio, which is quite big for Berkshire. The other reductions were like, it changed the portfolio by 0.12%. So it's like, well, that doesn't matter.
Right.
But yeah, so they're the reductions. There was one new buy for the quarter, which was Aon, which is an insurance company. So that one slotted into the 25th largest position in the portfolio. It holds 0.35% of the portfolio.
That's an interesting one because I was looking at Datarama this morning as well. And I like to look at, so Datarama has all of these guru investors that they put in a list and then they see what trades they're making. And Aon was one of the most bought stocks during the last quarter. I think it was fifth or sixth on the list. And there were six different big air quote guru investors, institutional investors that had invested into or for the first time or added to Aon during the quarter.
Right.
So yeah, it was up there.
Okay. Mm. And this is why, like, that's exactly why I love getting these 13Fs because it's just, I mean, it's just a guiding light. It's, from what you just said, if we're just some amateur investor trying to look for potential investment opportunities, say you work, say your day job is in insurance, so you really understand that industry, and then you log on to Datarama and it says, hey, like six of the world's best investors are buying Aon in Q1, then it obviously you don't go out and buy Aon because they're buying it, but it's like, oh, I know something about insurance. I might just put Aon on my watch list and I might go read a couple of annual reports. I might go look at their management team. I might look at whether they have some sort of advantage over the other insurance companies. I mean, that's why I love getting the 13F stuff so much is that it just puts things on your radar. It's just tapping into the best investing minds in the world and you just get stock ideas that you can research further. You just get all these ideas for free. I mean, it's genius.
Yeah. It's very, anyway, very good.
I love it. I love it. All right. Last thing to say on this, and then we'll move on. We've been talking about this for a while. He added to four stocks. So he bought a new stock in Aon and then he added to four, but there were only two that were notable significant additions to Verizon. So added 8% to that position. That's like one of his top positions now. It's in the top 10. I think it's like his sixth largest position, something like that.
Yeah.
It's quite a sizable position. He also added to Kroger, 52% to Kroger, which I believe is America's largest grocery chain.
Grocery chain, yeah, correct.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, sorry, I'm lacking a little bit of contextual data there.
Yeah.
Sitting here in Canberra, Australia, but that's okay. But yeah, obviously back in wanting to back Kroger, definitely.
Mm, very interesting. Yeah, so Verizon continues to become a larger and larger position. He's obviously very confident on that one. Not a business I'm particularly interested in. I did look into Kroger a little while ago and I wasn't overly impressed. I thought it was a solid business, but relative to its valuation, I didn't think it was amazing, but maybe Buffett sees something specific in Kroger that I don't see. Maybe it's an inflation play in that if there is larger inflation that a business that people are constantly going to, regardless of what is happening, that can raise their prices will be a little bit more protected than other businesses. But yeah, I don't know. Very interesting.
Yep. Yeah, exactly right. And I think that just about wraps up Warren Buffett's 13F filing. I haven't had a chance to go in deep and look at some of the other investors' 13F, so we might have to save some of that for next week. Next up, do you want to talk about Tesla and Bitcoin? And then we'll roll into more generally about Bitcoin.
Because
there's just so much going on at the moment.
Yeah.
So I'll start here. I think it was last week. Anyway, the headline is Tesla, you know how they were accepting Bitcoin? You could literally go and buy a Tesla with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And they only implemented that like last month. Anyway, guess what? They're not doing it anymore. They are not accepting Bitcoin as a payment method. So Elon actually took to Twitter to announce this news. So on the 13th of May, he posted a like text picture. Clearly, he had too many characters. So this post said, Tesla has suspended vehicle purchases using Bitcoin. We are concerned about rapidly increasing use of fossil fuels for Bitcoin mining and transactions, especially coal, which has the worst emissions of any fuel. Cryptocurrency is a good idea on many levels, and we believe it has a promising future, but this cannot come at great cost to the environment. Tesla will not be selling any Bitcoin, and we intend to use it for transactions as soon as mining transitions to more sustainable energy. We are also looking at other cryptocurrencies that use less than 1% of Bitcoin's energy per transaction.
Wow. Talk about a backflip on that.
Yeah. Backtrack. Whoop, rewind.
I mean, when they initially announced that, I mean, when they bought the Bitcoin, and maybe I have a misinformed opinion here, but when they bought that $1.5 billion chunk of Bitcoin and then they said they were going to accept payments, it all just seemed like Elon was just, at least from my perspective, that he was just kind of feeding into the cryptocurrency hype. And so it really doesn't surprise me that they're turning around on this. In fact, I know that we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next story, but I also wouldn't be surprised if they turned around in a month and said, yeah, we sold our entire Bitcoin position. So, yeah, I don't know. When it happened in the first place, it didn't seem like it was like a well thought out idea, at least from my perspective. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember we talked about it too. I mean, the whole idea of buying a car with Bitcoin didn't even make sense because of all the tax issues. I mean, you were making it more expensive for yourself by buying it in Bitcoin because you'd trigger a capital gain event, then you'd pay the tax on your capital gain. And so that'd essentially make the car, you know, more expensive unless you just paid for it in cash. But anyway. They're not accepting Bitcoin anymore, but they're also not selling their Bitcoin position. Elon followed up, to clarify speculation, Tesla has not sold any Bitcoin because people were just accusing him of just using his influence to mess with the price, essentially. Yeah. Because there's no doubt the Bitcoin price definitely moved from what Elon said about it. The thing. He didn't. This is the crazy thing. People saying, oh, look, he's pumping and dumping Bitcoin or he's manipulating Bitcoin. He's not doing anything of the sort. People that are buying Bitcoin are just taking action based on what he says. It's not like he's not posting on his Twitter, hey, everyone, you should buy Bitcoin. It's a smart investment idea. And then after he says that, Bitcoin price spikes and then he sells all of his Bitcoin as a pump and dump. It's not like he's saying that. He's just talking about what his company is doing when it comes to Bitcoin and the decisions that they're making. And he's getting accused of like manipulating the price. It's like, what the hell?
Anyway. I think that's obviously so true. I think if he was actually manipulating the price, Tesla would have sold their Bitcoin before they made this announcement because that announcement in terms of them no longer accepting Bitcoin had a significant negative impact on the price of Bitcoin. So I don't think that argument holds true. I think it
doesn't hold up at all.
I don't know. To me, I think Elon's just having a little bit too much fun and maybe he doesn't. That's not true. I'm sure he does know how much influence he's having on it, but.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it is very strange. I mean, cryptocurrencies just generally have been on a wild ride. I mean, I was just looking through to see if there was anything new that had happened this morning. And I mean, there's always, seems to be always stuff going on in the last couple of weeks with cryptocurrencies. So as you mentioned, Elon had already said previously or last week that Tesla was not selling any Bitcoin. This morning he tweeted, Tesla has diamond hands, which is a cryptocurrency slang for Tesla wanting to hold on to or is going to hold on to their $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. So
yep.
That tweet alone, or well, it seems to be that tweet alone, sent Bitcoin up about 20% in a few hours this morning.
Gosh.
So it's moving around a lot. And I mean, that 20% rise does come on the back of Bitcoin still being down 34% from its April highs. So it is still kind of in a downward trend, and further downward pressure may be coming as cryptocurrencies are also being affected by a China ban that happened, I think, yesterday. So China has now banned institutions, including banks and online payments channels in China, from making payments or allowing any services involving cryptocurrencies. So that's a big news coming out of a country where I'm sure a lot of people hold Bitcoin and are using it to transact. They didn't actually ban owning Bitcoin, which I mean, kind of makes sense. I feel like you can't really ban owning Bitcoin. No. It's kind of ridiculous. I know some countries have done that, but it's not as if you can actually prevent people from owning it or check if they do in any way. Interesting to see if that has any kind of continued effects on cryptocurrencies. I'm not sure.
Did you see the really short flash crash in Bitcoin that happened on the 19th?
No, I did not see that.
No.
Yeah.
Type in Bitcoin price and get up that chart and just go to like the 5-day chart.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It did actually have quite a...
Did you see that?
Yeah.
It actually went... I think it went... at one point, at its worst, it was below $30,000 per Bitcoin. So, for those that aren't looking at the chart, we're looking at it. It's now at $35,000. It was at $40,000 at about 1 o'clock.
Mm.
Yeah, about 1 o'clock on the 19th of May, the Bitcoin price just suddenly fell through the floor in literally about half an hour. And it went from about 38,000 down below 30,000, I believe.
Mm.
And now it's bounced back up a little bit. But yeah, it was just like snap of the fingers, boom. And that's the problem. Well, yes, this can happen to any asset. It could happen to a stock as well. I mean, with Bitcoin, I mean, there's no reason why there's no reason why tomorrow Bitcoin price couldn't be $100,000 per Bitcoin. Mm. There's no reason why tomorrow it couldn't be $10 per Bitcoin, you know?
Yeah.
There's just, as we always say, there's just nothing standing behind a Bitcoin.
Yeah. No,
there's just there's no money making capability that backs the value of a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like a share in a public company.
Exactly. There's nothing behind it. So nobody knows where it should be settling, like what's a normal price for it. And as a result, yeah, you get these wild, volatile swings. Kathy Woods, who is, of course, of ARK Invest and is very confident in Bitcoin still, she came out and did, she was on CNBC and she gave another price target, or she reiterated her previous price target, I should say, from last year, which is that Bitcoin is headed for 500,000 a coin, which is more than...
That's a very, very round number. You know, when I do these estimations of future value and intrinsic value, it's very rare that I end up on a nice round number. That's bizarre that her models have just landed her on a nice round number of $500,000. That almost never happens.
Amazing.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it's I don't know what's gonna happen from here. I think we I've said this a couple of times. We have to remember what our predictions were at the start of the year that we made. We made a couple. We made one on cryptocurrency well. I think we both said that cryptocurrencies would be lower than they were at the start of the year. I'm not sure. I think that's what I said.
Are we on track? What's the year to date? We would be, wouldn't we?
Let's have a look.
Oh no, probably about even. No, not quite. Roughly even.
Yeah,
roughly even.
It's roughly, well, Bitcoin roughly
it's
flat.
Neck and neck.
Yeah. Wow.
There we go. Not that we really care. No. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Anyway, Bitcoin, eh?
Yeah, I think that's enough about
That's
about
enough.
Cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
I'm not that enthused about them, I'll be honest.
Nah. Yeah. It's just go to the casino. It's more fun.
Mm.
All right. Tell me about what's, geez, more Tesla news.
Yeah, we've got
Tesla.
There is a lot going on with Tesla, Bitcoin. Oh, there is so much going on at the moment. We have to talk about this. So, of course, within all of the 13F filings, there was one news story that came out that was quite astounding. And that was around Michael Burry's 13F filing. And within that 13F filing, we could see options contracts is also something you can see within that portfolio. And it revealed a $530 million bet against Tesla.
Wow. Half a billion.
$500 million. It's a big, big bet. So, in terms of the details of this, so specifically, he revealed put options of 8,001 contracts of put options.
Okay.
And I'll explain what these are in just a second, just to refresh everyone's memory. But each contract represents 100 shares. So in total, he's betting against 800,100 shares of Tesla stock.
Which
is a lot of Tesla stock. And basically a put option is basically gives you the right. It's a contract that gives you the right, but not the obligation to sell a stock at a certain fixed price. So we've spoken about call options previously where you have the right to buy a stock at a fixed price. A put option is the right to sell a stock at a fixed option. So basically, Burry will make money if the stock falls, because if the stock falls, then he can buy Tesla stock at that low price and then execute the contract and sell them at the higher price. So that's how a put option works. And of course, if the stock price goes up and it doesn't make any sense for him to execute the contracts, then he is out the amount of the contracts. And that's the risk with options contracts, is that if the stock doesn't go the direction you expect, then you don't own any underlying stock. You don't actually own Tesla stock. You're not you're not short Tesla stock. You just pay for the contract and the contract expires and you're just out a bunch of money. So it's not as if he's risking $500 million. That's just the value of the Tesla shares that he is betting against.
Well, there you go. So that is a big bet. But, I mean, obviously, the one thing we don't know is what time frame these option contracts are for, right?
Correct. Yeah. So we don't know. I mean, you could have these, there's options contracts that go for a month, a week. Some of them go up to 2 years. So we have no idea what length it is. But
if he made this in, was it in January?
Yes.
Yeah. So in and I guess the stock price has gone down since January. So if he's still got those contracts, if they're still open, then he would be in the money.
Yeah, I mean, it also just depends, I guess, on the strike price of the contract. So, what was the fixed price that he was able to sell the stock at? But assuming it was anywhere near the current stock price between, you know, January or February, then you would expect that he's positive on this investment, at least now. But we don't know how long the contract goes for, whether he will execute them early or whatever.
True.
So,
it's hard to know for certain.
It's very hard to know. But, this kind of brought up some news around Burry's previous thesis on Tesla, which he didn't reiterate this week, but he had spoken about previously before he deleted all of his tweets. But this kind of got recirculated. And I actually hadn't heard this. I actually hadn't gone through his thesis on why he's betting against Tesla before, but it is kind of interesting. So, part of it is that Tesla relies on these regulatory credits to remain profitable. So Tesla at the moment is selling these regulatory credits to other automakers so that those automakers can comply with environmental regulations. So they're able to make money because of the fact that Tesla is on the good side of the environmental regulations and the other automakers are not, and therefore have to buy these credits from them. But his argument, Burry's argument, is that as automakers start to sell their own EVs, there will just be progressively less demand for buying those credits from Tesla. As they'll be able to get their own credits from being from selling EVs. So that's an interesting situation, and specifically in terms of how this looks for Tesla's profitability. In the fourth quarter of 2020, Tesla sold $401 million worth of regulatory credits, which were primarily zero emissions credits. And during that quarter, their profit was $270 million. So excluding the regulatory credits, which don't have any costs associated with them, I would presume.
Yeah.
So you can kind of just chop that off their profit figure. They actually didn't make money in the fourth quarter of 2020.
Interesting.
Which is very interesting because, of course, remember, they had to have four quarters of profitability to get into the S&P 500. So it would have been interesting to see how excluding regulatory credits would have impacted that, whether they would have actually been able to get into the S&P 500. And it is very interesting.
I think, to be honest, though, in Tesla's position, they can, obviously they see their financial results coming. And I think because Elon said in the past that they want to remain just slightly profitable, but not really a crazy, they don't want to be a money printing machine for their shareholders just yet, because they want to keep obviously reinvesting back into the business and building factories and increasing manufacturing output and that sort of stuff. So I wonder if, you know, even if the regulatory credits weren't a thing, would Tesla have been able to maybe cut back on this or adjust their numbers here and there so that they still ended up with just a slight profit? Because that seems like what they've been doing. They've just been maintaining like a modest level of profitability. Like they're not trying to just knock it out of the park and go, oh, look at us. They're just trying to maintain that slight profitability, and then everything else would just pump it back into the business kind of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, it's still a decent thesis. I mean, if they weren't able to wiggle around, then you're right. If you exclude the regulatory credits, then they wouldn't have made any money whatsoever. So
yeah, it is very interesting. Obviously, I know very little about Tesla's actual operations, but I mean, Burry has not been shy of talking about how overvalued Tesla has been previously. So it's not very surprising, I think, to see this bet, but how it will play out, I don't know. We'll see. Can the big Mr. Big Short do it again?
Yeah, I don't know. To be honest, Jesus, I just wouldn't bet against Elon Musk. There's only one person in this world that I probably wouldn't bet against, and it's him. Oh, dear.
I mean, that stock is like the darling of speculation as well. So
I know,
it's not a stock that I would be confident would move with intrinsic value. So using an intrinsic value argument to bet against it would be difficult, I think. Because
you could argue it both ways. You could argue it's the darling of speculation, so that's why you should short it, because obviously it's just pumped up on speculation. And then you can use your argument, which I agree with, where you can, you know, that's the reason why you don't want to bet against it, because it's just speculative and it could go a hell of a lot higher based on absolutely nothing changing with the business. So I know personally, this is always just like, I think this is a good general test of whether you've made a good investment or whether you're comfortable in an investment. You know, I feel like if I was short Tesla, I just wouldn't sleep well at night. I feel like I would be on my phone in the middle of the night watching the Tesla stock price saying, please go down, please go down, please go down. Oh shit, it's up another 4% today. Oh, it's gone up 10% in a day. Uh-oh, like I'd be sweating bullets at 1 in the morning, not being able to sleep, because I'd be watching the markets because I'm short Tesla and it's just pumped on speculation. So
yeah,
I feel like that's always the good. If you think about your investment and you feel a little bit nervous about it, then you probably aren't confident in it, or you probably don't know enough to be confident in it. So that's kind of like a rule of thumb that I have.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, with any of these bets, it's a short-term bet, really. And I think whatever happens in the short term to Tesla is, or for any stock for that matter, is incredibly unpredictable. So we will see. We'll see what happens with his huge
crystal ball.
Yeah.
All right, shall we move on?
Yeah, what have we got? What else have we got?
I should talk about Disney earnings. I do like to follow Disney. So I'll just give you an update, because this is a business that has been heavily impacted by COVID. Extremely, you know, adversely impacted. You just think about what they do. I mean, direct to consumer, that probably would have... that, well, that has benefited from COVID. But apart from that, making movies, you know, cinemas, that sort of stuff, getting just no one going to cinemas, theme parks, cruise ships. There's just a lot of things that can be impacted by COVID that have been when it comes to Disney. So, right at the top, and it says right at the top of their earnings release, it says results for the quarter and 6 months ended April 3rd, 2021 were adversely impacted by COVID. The most significant impact was at the Disney Parks Experiences and Products segment, where since late in the second quarter of fiscal 2020, our parks and resorts have been closed or operating at significantly reduced capacity, and our cruise ship sailings have been suspended. So, it's a really interesting time for Disney because they're getting obviously hammered when it comes to cruise ships, when it comes to theme parks, when it comes to movies. However, like Netflix, they're also benefiting greatly from direct-to-consumer having a streaming service. Everybody, you know, we've talked about how much pull forward there was from Netflix, people that were on the fence, but because they were locked down, they were just like, ah, may as well get Netflix now. So, same thing, you know, Disney Plus now. When did it launch? Probably launched like October-ish 2019, maybe, so. I want to say.
That sounds correct, yeah.
Even just like at the end of Q1 2021, Disney Plus had 103.6 million subscribers, paying subscribers.
That's
up nine.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty insane, isn't it?
That is crazy, yeah. Wow.
They've just piled them on.
Yeah, I mean, what does Netflix have at the moment? 160 million or something more?
I think they're up at like 200.
Really? Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, I was way off on that.
Yeah.
Netflix.
But I mean, even for Disney to just be, you know, 50% behind.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Yeah. Not bad.
So, Netflix is at 208 million subscribers.
208.
Yeah.
And you think about how long has Netflix been in this business for versus Disney? Disney's been in it for what? A year and a bit? Netflix has been in it for years and years and years and years. And that's just the power of brands, the power of content. But anyway, so that number was up 9% quarter over quarter. Hulu, they now have 41.6 million subscribers on Hulu, which is up 5.6% quarter over quarter. And they now have 13.8 million subscribers on ESPN Plus, which is up 14% quarter over quarter.
Wow.
So very, very impressive results out of the subscription services, in terms of subscriber additions anyway. However, this, man, Disney, they got to stop changing this. They used to report, you know how they used to report four revenue segments?
Yeah.
It used to be media networks, studio entertainment, parks and resorts, and then direct to consumer. I mean, that just made so much sense in my head.
Yeah.
But not anymore. Now they report just two revenue segments.
Oh, they don't.
Which
do
is, they do. Oh. It is Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution.
That is the.
How is that for a load of crap?
That is the dumbest thing ever. And the reason why is because it hides the poor performance of their media networks, or not media. Yeah, their media network segment, which is the last thing you want is. I really dislike, this is a pet peeve for me. I really dislike when a management team thinks that by showing less information, shareholders will be happier, that they can somehow protect their share price a little bit. It's ridiculous. A true shareholder, a true owner of the business wants complete transparency.
Yes.
And that actually really disappoints me about Disney's management.
I'm struggling to even understand it. So I think So there's Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution. That's the first one. And then there's Disney Parks Experiences and Products. So I believe Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution is networks, studio entertainment, direct to consumer, and content licensing.
Yep.
I think all of that falls under. However, and this is what this is just really annoys the crap out of me. Like, they don't. In the whole earnings report, I was trying to find information on just studio entertainment. They do not release, they didn't even mention studio entertainment in this whole report. So that Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution, they did this whole spiel talking about broadcasting and TV channels, their media network side of their business. They spent a whole chunk of time talking about their direct to consumer, Disney Plus, and blah blah blah. And then I'm like, what about the movies? I'm like, are they just not talking about the movies because they're going straight to direct to consumer? and they're not going to cinemas because cinemas are like shut in the US or something. Like, I have got no idea, but it's just so confusing. Why do you do this? Anyway, little rant over.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just what we're... Sorry, yeah,
no, you go. All I was just going to say, the last thing on this, I think it really does tell you a lot about the management team when they do stuff like this, because really good management teams, and I'm not saying that Disney is a bad management team just off this one thing, but really good management teams, they just are so transparent in numbers, regardless of whether they're bad numbers. And they talk about the bad numbers, like right at the top of the report and what they're doing to fix it. There's nothing worse than seeing a company that hides important numbers just because they're doing poorly and then praises those numbers right at the front of, on the front page of the annual report when they're doing well. It's it's so transparent to me about what the management team is trying to do when that happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we'll try and work with it. So overall, here's a number that they have to report. Revenue, total revenue. Good luck hiding that one. So total revenue came in at $15.6 billion, which is down 13% year over year. So for that first bracket, they had $12.4 billion of revenue for Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution, which is up 1% year over year. So interestingly, out of that, direct-to-consumer revenue grew 44% year-over-year to $4 billion. So, direct-to-consumer really getting a big boost. And during the call, I listened to just the start of the call. I said they are near full production in their studios now. But as I said before, I get really confused because there's just like no reference to this in the actual earnings release. And yeah, like I said, I don't know whether that's just the movies gone direct to consumer or are they just working on TV shows at the moment? Like, I don't know. So anyway, $12.4 billion in Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution, up 1% year over year. Then $3.2 billion for Disney Parks, Experiences and Products, which is down 44% year over year.
Ooh.
Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Yeah. And they do actually go into a little bit of detail here, but it's as you would expect. I mean, when we're talking about theme parks, you know, cruise lines, that sort of stuff, it says from their earnings release, as a result of COVID-19, Disneyland Resort and Disneyland Paris were closed and our cruise business was suspended for all of the current quarter, whereas these businesses closed in mid-March of the prior year. Our parks and resorts that were open during the quarter operated at significantly reduced capacities. So that, yeah, still a big struggle, obviously, with COVID. Opening a place like a theme park where you just get thousands, tens of thousands of people just mingling, riding rides together, sharing ice creams and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, it's like the last thing you want to be doing during a global pandemic. But probably, I think Disney, I'm sure Disney is very confident on their parks because they have such good brand value there or brand power there that it would not surprise me that, you know, you give them 18 months, 2 years and these parks will be back to full capacity and maybe even making even more money than previously. Maybe they can charge $800 for entry. Maybe they can.
But yeah, that's the thing is that you, even when you read that, you know, down 44% year over year, you never does it cross my mind. Oh my gosh, is Disneyland ever going to be the same again? That just doesn't come into my mind at all. In my mind, I'm like, well, of course Disneyland's going to be back at full capacity. It's just a matter of when are they able to do that?
Yep.
And it's exactly as you say, it's all down to branding. It's all down to, you know, the branding, the legacy, it's stood the test of time and has just been around for so long. It's got that competitive advantage over other theme parks. You know, if somebody says name one theme park in the world, probably most people would say, oh, Disneyland.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. A little bit of other stuff. Operating income came in. So overall, what did they do? $15.6 billion in revenue. Operating income, $1.4 billion. So pretty much exactly flat year over year. However, net income was higher this quarter at $900 million versus $460 million for Q1 2020. So the EPS was 50 cents versus 26 cents for Q1 2020.
Wow. Okay.
So there you go.
That's interesting. Yeah, revenue down, but profitability was up.
Yep. Operating income flat. Yeah. Profitability up. So there you go.
Very good.
That's about all I had to say on Disney.
Yeah. How did their stock do? Let's have a look.
Yeah, I don't know,
movement?
Actually. I didn't even look.
A little bit.
Isn't that a good sign? Isn't that a good sign that I'm a value investor? I didn't even look at what the stock did.
Amazing. Very impressive. it didn't move at all. Down 0.1% or something. So.
Right. That's probably because people are still trying to figure out what the hell they're talking about in this earnings release. Wait, so hang on. So the media distribution... say that again.
Everyone's still adjusting their models. Like, yeah, how do we deal with this?
I don't know. Where, do they make movies? Does Disney make movies anymore? I don't know. I can't figure it out. Anyway.
Oh, dear. All right.
Anyway.
Should we do some Q&A before we finish?
Yeah, let's fly through a couple.
Yeah, where can we go?
I added some new ones down here. Oh, let's talk about this one.
Okay.
Quick question. This might put your brain to work.
Ooh.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer a management team to buy back stock or issue a dividend?
Well, I think I prefer them to buy back stock if the stock is severely undervalued. So if it's really undervalued, then the management team is going to get good bang for their buck, basically investing in their own stock in a way, because they're enabling the existing owners. Well, they're enabling some owners to get out by buying stock from them. And they're enabling owners who want to remain owners to have a larger piece of the business for a really undervalued price. But I mean, if they are issuing a dividend, I guess the buyback probably avoids one tax event. Say if you were to receive the dividend and then pay tax and then buy the stock yourself and increase your ownership in that way, which would ultimately end up in the same position as if the company had bought back stock. But I think buying back stock would be more tax efficient for you as an investor if you're a long-term investor and the stock is undervalued. But if the stock is not undervalued, then probably issuing a dividend so that you can put the money somewhere else.
Yeah, that's what I think as well. Because, I mean, otherwise it's just ineffective use of money if you're just buying expensive stocks. I mean, no one wants to buy expensive stocks. That's like what we're trying to avoid, right?
Yeah. The only time you want management to be buying back the stock when it's expensive is if you want to sell it, because then you can sell it to the management team, overvalued.
True.
You can be done with it.
And I guess they're supporting the buy volume.
Exactly. It's like one last push of overvaluedness and you can get out.
Thank you. I'm out. See you guys. Suck it.
Honestly, feels like Starbucks is doing that sometimes with the amount of debt they take on and the continued effort to buy the stock at a ridiculous valuation. It's just like...
They're doing the ultimate. They're taking on debt and using all that debt to buy back stock to pump the stock price with buy pressure. And then once the stock price is really high, then they're going to raise capital at a super over.
it's kind of laughable, because not only are they using cash to buy an overvalued stock, they're actually stealing from long-term investors by taking on debt. They're stealing from future profits buy back. Yeah. Anyway, that's my little rant on Starbucks.
It's so funny though. And most people, if you told them that, they'd just be like, wait, what? I don't get it. It's like, you don't realize that they are screwing you over. They are not being nice to you right now. You should be angry at this.
crazy.
I don't get it. They're buying back stock and I like that, right? It increases my ownership, right? Anyway, all right. Should we do maybe one or two?
Yeah,
more
can
questions?
I read this one to you? This one's not investing related.
Sure.
But
go.
This is an interesting one.
I have no idea what you're about to say. Okay, sure.
Guys, I have a question for you. Do you keep all of the raw footage you record in your YouTube videos, or do you delete it? I'm interested in knowing. My brother is starting a YouTube channel, but he has already ran out of space with the second video he made. Yeah, it does take up a lot of space.
Yeah, it does.
What are your thoughts on that?
I do not keep my raw footage, because you're right. I would just, the amount of space it would take up. I mean, I know that some content creators, they have, what are they called? Those like ultra mega, what are they called? Like NAVs or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it stands for, but it's like this ultra backup hard drive, which is literally like, you can scale them up to be like 100 terabytes.
Yeah, it's like a mini server room, basically, where you could store everything as a backup.
And then you can have all of your original files in nice high quality, all the, just the original stuff. And if you ever need to go back and take a clip. But to be honest, there's just no way I can afford doing that. No. It's just... so I have my raw for, cause we like you're recording in 4K.
Yeah.
I'm recording in 1080p, but, like at very, what do they call it? High bit rate, I think.
Mm.
But just a lot of data for the 1080p. It just improves the quality of the 1080p essentially. But yeah, those, if you kept those files, man, holy smokes, you would need a lot of room.
Yeah.
You'd need a lot of room.
Yeah. No.
Do you keep them?
No. I've kept some in the past. I don't keep them like religiously though. So like if I need space, they go first, but I don't delete them like immediately. So I move everything, all the files over to a really, really big hard drive. And then when I need space, I delete the raw files. But yeah. No, you can't keep all the raw footage, especially when you're getting started. It's not that important. Maybe if at some point down the line and you have the funds to do that, and that's something that would that you want to do to make sure you have as much of your own content as possible, then yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we wrap it up there? Should we do one more? We're at an hour.
Yeah. Nah, let's do one. Now that you've given me the option, we have to do one more. We can't.
Okay, sure. All right, what one should we do? Should we do this one?
Yeah.
Let's do this one. Hey, guys, been following your podcast for the last few months. Great work. Please keep it up. Thank you very much. Thanks for your support. Thank you. A question for you two. Okay, so we've got low interest rates, we've got rising inflation, and we've got speculative real estate and equity markets. Correct. Where do you put your cash right now? Thanks.
That's a really good question.
Obviously, like we can't tell you what to do with your money.
Don't listen to Brandon.
No financial advice here. But do you have any thoughts? Where do you put your cash right now?
Yeah.
Is there a good place you can put your cash right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on what your strategy is and what your expectations are for some of those things in the future, because so in your question, you've kind of said with low interest rates and rising inflation, but I think we don't really know whether inflation will rise or not. And as a result, there's, you know, kind of a lot of people have a lot of opinions about what you should do with your money. But in terms of my philosophy, I'm very much down Warren Buffett's core principles in that I'm mostly invested in the markets, in businesses that if there is inflation, those businesses will be rising their prices of their products and therefore their revenues and protected a little bit from inflation. And in terms of cash, I mean, I have it in a high interest savings account, but a high interest savings account in Australia at the moment. Yeah, exactly. It's a bit laughable. It's probably maybe 1% at best, I think, maybe 1.3% or something like that. But that's all I do. And I'm happy to hold cash in the short term in the event that there's an opportunity to invest in a good business and then put money into that business.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. When you hold all your cash and then inflation comes along, it's like, oh, my money's worth less and less. I totally agree with you. I tend to follow what Warren Buffett has said about, I think just generally, you tend to want to keep most of your money in great businesses most of the time.
Yeah.
That's kind of my philosophy. You know, if you're looking over a 40-year period, I would like to keep over that 40-year period most of my money in high quality cash producing businesses. And I think the thing that you touched on that's really important to remember at this time is the competitive advantage, because it's the competitive advantage that makes the business less susceptible to the effects of inflation, because there are businesses, say Adobe or something else, that has that switching mode. Businesses are going to struggle to switch away from their products. So they've got this ecosystem. They've got people locked in. Apple's another one I think you just mentioned. They've got people locked in. They've got their customers locked in. So if inflation came along and it's like, oh, great, our profits aren't really worth as much as what they just were, then there's no reason why they can't increase those prices. Maybe generally business is affected across the board, but that there are businesses that can raise their prices and get away with it, and there are businesses that can raise their prices and will suffer for it. And it's the ones with the competitive advantages that can raise prices and get away with it to negate the effects of harsh inflation, like an Apple. Like, if we saw massive inflation, Apple would just be like, oh, we'll just charge a little bit more across the board on all our products. Make our products, like, I don't know, 4% more expensive. People are still going to buy iPhones. They're still going to buy AirPods. They're still going to buy everything.
Yeah, and I mean, on that point, Apple's been raising the price by about 10 to 20% a year, regardless. So.
Exactly. In a low inflation environment, they'd be raised that, and people have been like, ah, yeah, let's go. I'll pay you $5,000 for an iPhone. Let's go.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's crazy. I think that's a really good point to end today's podcast on. So thanks everyone for tuning in. And as always, if you do have questions that you want to ask, then head over to the YouTube version of the podcast at youtube.com/The Young Investors Podcast. Click on the latest episode. And as a comment, you can leave your questions or news topics or anything like that that you want us to discuss. Thanks to ShareSite, as always, for sponsoring. Again, ShareSite.com/young investors if you want to try a free plan or sign up to a paid plan and get 4 months off a yearly subscription. Thanks, ShareSite, for sponsoring. And thanks, Brandon, for joining us, as always.
No worries.
And we'll see you guys next week.
See you later.